The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Good morning. How's it going? Okay, so I've got a point in my talk where it says insert thesis paragraph here. So just bear with me. I was revising into the night. Okay, so just to begin. So here's some breaking news. Donald Trump is a big, fat, lying liar. So it's audience participation time. What has Donald Trump lied about?
Everything.
Okay, but specifically?
Crowd's inauguration.
Job growth.
Illegal voter fraud.
Voter fraud.
His own typos.
Oh, yeah. Huh?
Oh, the coal industry,
uh-huh.
His hair.
Say that again.
His hair.
Unemployment.
So we got a good list going on here. And in fact, there are so many that keeping track of his tall tales is nearly impossible. And that's not to say that people haven't tried. The New York Times, for example, attempted to record every lie that Trump told in his first 100 days as president. And so, here we go. January 21st, I didn't want to go into Iraq. I've been on the cover of Time 14 or 15 times. January 23, 3 to 5 million illegal votes caused me to lose the popular election. January 25, now the audience was the biggest ever. January 24th, Pew reports show voter fraud. January 25th, you had millions of people that now are not insured anymore. Also, his grammar is terrible. January 25, two people were killed in Chicago during the president's speech. January 26, we've taken in tens of thousands of people. They didn't vet them. January 27, just kidding, I'm not gonna go through the whole list. But what I will argue today is that neither fake news nor the critique of the fake news is new. And also, even though it's not new, there's this rise of a panic about truth and facts and this sort of hysteria, although I hate to use that word, but frenzy about the post-truth era. And this panic is misleading because the truth is very complicated, and in fact, it has class belonging, right? So there are their truths and ours. And so the mainstream media can't really present a view of the world that is sufficient for our side, and therefore we need outlets for our own side. So that is basically where I'm going in this talk. So. Carrying on. From voter fraud to the murder rate, from job creation to immigration, from wiretapping to fake Time magazine covers. Did you hear that about that one? Okay. And of course, regarding Russian involvement in the presidential election, from January to June, it turns out Trump was lying at least 50% of the time. The man is the magnate of mendacity. As Danny Katch wrote in The Socialist Worker, he lies so often that this whole category of his lies are denials of previous lies. So on a more serious note, many of his lies are quite dangerous, right? Especially his lies about Muslims and immigrants. These are lies that fuel persecution, vigilantism, and more. At the same time, Trump is hardly the first politician to lie to the people, and there is nothing new about deception in politics. Of course, we want to demand truth from the nation's leaders, but when have they ever told us the truth? The Times would have us believe that Trump uniquely is, quote, trying to create an atmosphere in which reality is irrelevant. So, I'm sorry, I seem to remember when a president told a whopper of a lie that got the U.S. involved in an endless war. Yes, George H.W. Bush lied about Iraqis raiding baby incubators in Kuwait. And yes, Colin Powell lied to the UN about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But I was actually thinking of Democrat Lyndon Baines Johnson, who lied about the destruction of a U.S. ship in the Gulf of Tonkin, a lie that began the U.S. war in Vietnam, resulting in a massive death toll and series of war crimes and atrocities committed by the United States. And it's certainly not the first time that media have been criticized for producing fake news. Trump's animosity toward the press has historical precedent. In 1641, in the colonies, the governor of Virginia wrote, and I quote, "I thank God there are no free schools nor printing, for learning has brought disobedience and heresy and sex," not sexy, S-E-X, sex, S-E-C-T-S, although probably the first one too, and printing has divulged them and libels against the government," end quote. And during the lead up to the American War for Independence, the number of newspapers in their reach exploded and became tools of the revolutionary movement. The self-interest of an emerging bourgeois class teamed up with political resistance to the monarchy in a journalistic movement fueled by commerce. Newspapers later became organs of new political parties in that revolutionary period as in others. Media consolidates class power and political strategy. So these hostility of journalists in the 18th century sort of rivals what politicians say about the media today. For example, in the 1800 presidential campaign, major papers called George Washington a traitor, a robber, and a perjurer, and John Adams a hoary-headed incendiary. Jefferson returned the invective, writing in 1807, "The newspapers of our country, by their abandoned spirit of falsehood, have more effectively destroyed the utility of the press than all the shackles devised by Bonaparte." He said, "They fill their newspapers with falsehoods, calumnies, and audacities." In other words, he said, "Fake news, not fair." And to the charge that Trump has just now ushered in the post-truth era, Jefferson wrote that the news were prostitutes to falsehood, saying, "Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that polluted vehicle." Sexism is quite wild there. According to media historian Jonathan Ladd, politicians, especially presidents, have adopted the strategy of criticizing the press to induce public distrust. Populist critiques of the media as elitist and fake have a very long history. So given that neither fake news nor the critique of fake news are anything new, I think that we need to look at the reigning frenzy about facts another way. Left-wing panic over Trump's brazen disregard for even the most trivial facts and pundits' resulting investment in massive apparatuses of fact-checking are, on the one hand, understandable. We should hold our leaders accountable to reality. But on the other hand, the panic does ideological work in redeeming mainstream news sources and democratic politicians who have lied outright with tragic consequences. The media before and during the Trump administration have been capitalist media and therefore have always committed another kind of falsehood, the framing of a reality riven by class division, racism, sexism, and so on in ways that obscure the causes and solutions to those problems. Lies are bad, but easier to identify. Mass-mediated ideology is more complicated and works to constrain political awareness, choice, and critique. So Murray Edelman argues in his book, Constructing the Media Spectacle, that mass media are not so concerned with facts as they are about constructing a political scene in ways that buttress inequalities and the status quo. In language and images, the news and political rhetoric define and perpetuate oppressive identities and social roles and construct narratives of power with heroes and enemies. Those constructs are neither facts nor lies, but they are the crafting of a particular version of reality. In spite of such complexity, there has been an explosion of efforts to fact-check contemporary political rhetoric, starting with those of the Tampa Bay Times PolitiFact Project and the fact-checking blog of Glenn Kessler at the Washington Post. Journalists who perform fact-checking investigate a politician's claim and rate it on some sort of truthometer scale from true or mostly true to pants on fire. Liar, liar, pants on fire. The American Press Institute has documented this surge. Though precise figures are hard to come by, the available evidence tells a fairly dramatic story about the growth of fact-checking. One account earlier this year found 29 branded fact-checking vendors in the United States, but all of five of which were established since 2010. Though dedicated, full-time fact-checkers remain relatively rare, although almost every major national newsroom has embraced the genre. So I could make a list of all the elite standard bearers in the news who engage in fact-checking. And so the New York Times, The Post, Associated Press, National Public Radio, USA Today, CNN, Fox, and MSNBC. So in addition, scores of smaller news outlets at the state and local level offer fact checks during elections or around major political events. So I'm going to kind of argue that the explosion of a post-truth frenzy represents what cultural studies scholar Stuart Hall called a moral panic, a whipped-up discourse about social disorder that ideologically places the blame for social crisis on the target of the panic. He indicted British news-induced panic in the 1980s over mugging in Britain. Like that panic, the alarm over fake news serves ideological functions. It re-legitimizes mainstream commercial news media as guardians of the truth, with the most dramatic proclamation in this regard, in my view, is when the Washington Post declared on its masthead, "Democracy dies in darkness." Also, this frenzy positions the Democratic Party, clearly located inside the business establishment, as the resistance. Progressives and critical scholars who once dissected the complicity of the Democrats in the news media with the imperatives of capitalism have now been encouraged to see those organizations as the valiant defense against real untruths. Moreover, erstwhile critics of state power have become champions of the FBI in its efforts to investigate Trump's abuses of power. All day long, reporters are trying to confirm or deny that Trump knew about Russian interference in the presidential election as if this were the major problem represented by his administration. So they're not fact-checking on racism, healthcare, immigration, terrorism, and so on. Fact-checking misses the forest for the trees. And so resorting to a narrow empirical baseline, these fact-checkers miss the point. It's not about what's in the box, but who gets to decide its boundaries and exclusions, and who gets to shape facts for public sense-making. And just for a minute about why liberals are so hot and bothered about fake news. And I think that it's really important to say that I think because liberal elitism allows them to blame the working class and its ignorance after a crisis at the election, because they couldn't acknowledge structural critique or the failure of the candidate to speak to the urgency of the crisis that exists for the working class in this country and around the world. So it can't be that something is wrong with the liberals, so it must be the working class and the fact that its members don't respect facts. So here's an example of fact-checking journalism that reveals the tendency of fact-checking to miss the point. It occurred before the election, and it's about the Inspector General's critical report on Hillary Clinton's use of personal phones for emails in her role as Secretary of State. In the article, which clocks in at 3,400 words, the factcheck.org writer takes each subcategory of the report's main claim that Clinton was wrong to use her personal email for official business. In the fact-checking process, it examines at great length Clinton's claims that her use of personal email was allowed by the State Department, fully complied with department regulations, and was the same thing as done by her predecessors. So they never get around to actually answering the question of whether Hillary Clinton lied to us. And, of course, a direct answer to that question would be yes, which goes to show you how fact-checking can obscure rather than lay bare the facts, depending on the ideological position of the checker. In its being limited to the examination of minutiae, the enterprise of fact-checking is itself ideological. And in Marxist terms, ideology is a system of ideas, largely implicit and naturalized so as to seem like common sense, that convinces people, notably the working class, to take part in a system that works against their own interests. So Marx identified some of these ideas in clusters of what he called bourgeois claptrap, including the justifications of the private family, religious authority, nationalism and patriotism, the naturalization of wealth and private property, racism, and so on. And we can add to that list ideas about individual responsibility and the American dream, about ideologically appropriate masculinity, femininity, and sexuality, and about the naturalness and inevitability of our social system, capitalism. For Marxist historians, critics, and other activists, it is necessary to combat these ideological ideas with the truths of women's oppression, the truths of injustice, truths about the atrocity of war, the grotesque disparities between rich and poor, and so on. But the idea that there are neutral facts is ideological. A media story can report facts about a situation, but employ a couple of different strategies, one of which is media framing, which principles of selection or emphasis that shape public perception, and also agenda setting, which tells us not what to think, but what to think about. I'll say a couple more words about that later. So critical media theorists have called attention to how commercial media, driven by corporate interests, employ media framing and agenda setting. And an agenda setting, just as an example, is everything that is said in the mass media and in the political domain about Russia. I mean, right? So we're, you know, massive protests at the G20, massive global crisis, you know, the persecution of immigrants and Muslims in this country, so, you know, and atrocities and tragedies everywhere, and we're supposed to be worried about Russia. So you watch coverage of the G20, and it's all about did Putin like Trump? And did, because apparently Trump was a different person in person. Did you see that news? Trump was a different person in person than he was, not in person. So here we are, even on MSNBC, spending about 15 minutes on that subject, and there's nothing about the protests, right? Or if there is, media framing comes into play and talks about that there's violence on both sides, that the protesters triggered the violence, that property damage is violence, violence, violence. So, in other words, these things shape the audience's view of the world. And even though the media certainly are subject to pressure from movements, they generally attempt to obscure the causes and solutions to the problems of the working class and the poor. So I wanted to take, for example, the New York Times coverage of the Grenfell fire in London, which the Times was pretty good at identifying some, you know, technically speaking, problems with the insulation, and even went so far as to critique deregulation, but they did not, for example, advise a labor government or explain that the basic cause was capitalism, which requires challenging by a mass movement. And of course, this is one a really particularly influential media frame in journalism, which is they presented both sides and quoted the developers saying that fire resistant walls are not financially viable. And as we've heard throughout the weekend, it was a matter of 5,000 pounds or so that would have saved those people. There would have been another cost to the property developer too, which is that once you give in to one regulation, mm-hmm. then that sets the precedent. And so I think there was a fear of sort of the domino effect there. But that's horrible in itself. But basically, they could have prevented those dozens of gruesome deaths. And the New York Times is telling us both sides. So we can contrast this with remarks by Corey Oakley, who contributed to Socialist Worker. People died in Grenfell Tower because they were poor. They died because the Conservative Party-dominated local council hated them and would not lift a finger to put measures in place to stop people burning in their beds. They died because public housing has been left to rot, and successive governments in the name of a quote-unquote war on red tape have ripped up safety regulations and left working-class people at the mercy of unscrupulous, cost-cutting private firms. Likewise, Tom Steele quipped in a column in Socialist Worker, "It is always welcome when someone explains when someone explains complex ideas in a way we can all understand. Now when someone asks, what is a crazy Marxist? All you have to say is someone silly enough to believe that if someone's house has burned down, they should be allowed to stay in an empty house." So media for our side are about explaining what seems complex to capitalists and politicians in ways that we can all understand as the product of a brutally unequal class system. So, as I started to mention before, the hype about this post-truth era lets corporate media off the hook. Again, you know, because we have had an alleged turn toward the dark side. And it also redeems two capitalist institutions, the Democratic Party and the corporate news media as a whole. I've already mentioned about democracy dies in darkness. And that phrase is taken from Bob Woodward's reporting on Watergate, which seems like a more appropriate place for saying something like that. So what is the implication of the statement now? And it is that the Post and all other corporate media are suddenly the source of the very light of democracy itself. And what about politicians? On May 2nd, the Huffington Post reported, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said she's not standing down after her loss to Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election. Quote, I'm back to being an activist citizen and part of the resistance. End quote. Clinton said during an interview in a Woman for Women event in New York on Tuesday. Clinton talked to journalist Christiane Amanpour about her post-election life, saying she's writing a book about her experience as the first woman presidential candidate for a major political party. She also opened up about her loss to Trump. I take absolute responsibility. I was the candidate. I was the person who was on the ballot. Okay, so that's a rare moment. But I think the point being is that democracy indeed dies in darkness when the Hillary Clintons of the world are claiming the space of the light. Moreover, this panic propagates a culture of elitism among liberals who believe it was the lack of facts among ignorant Americans that resulted in Trump's victory. Fact-checking is like other lecture porn, which I hope you've read about, which is when liberals congratulate themselves for hours and hours on MSNBC, mainly aimed at confirming the moral and intellectual superiority of its enlightened practitioners who take pleasure in nodding their heads and laughing about Trump's lies and his base's ignorance. And finally, the panic about truth presumes and convinces its followers that matters of truth and falsehood are simple, that we can identify universal truths as mirrors to hold up against lying politicians. Just as the media and political system deny that society is divided into classes, the ideology of fact-checking denies that the experience and interpretation of reality could also diverge along class lines. And as Trotsky said about morality, there is their morality and ours. We could also maybe say this about knowledge, there is their knowledge and ours. In this context, the panic over Trump's lies serves to redeem the capitalist system, its media, and the politicians. And so for this reason, I think a socialist approach to facts must go farther than this liberal elitist fact-checking. Now, of course, we must condemn Trump's lies as much as we would any other politicians. And the way those lies justify wars, the gutting of social services, police murder, the rollback of abortion rights, the persecution and murder of transgender persons, the vilification and scapegoating of Muslims and immigrants, and so on. And of course, we believe in and assert the importance of science when it comes to things like environmental apocalypse, abortion rights, and evolution. As socialists, we have to be about, to use a cliche, speaking truth to power. But our knowledge, based on the experiences of ordinary people, is not what passes for objectivity in the mainstream. There is no truth without politics, no knowledge that does not emerge from struggle. We may not trust governments or their media, but we listen closely to ordinary people, particularly when they are organized in large-scale protest. So, liberals and conservatives ask us to avoid partisan sources as fake news, as if in capitalism there could be any information that does not serve either their interests or ours. And I started to wonder, because what people call fake news is usually of two genres. One is satire, and the other is highly partisan or allegedly highly partisan news. So by their account, our news would be fake news, right? Because it's the, so anyway, but I'm a sucker for fake news, like especially for satire. I'm a very literal person, and so, but I did come across this headline this morning and had to wonder. The headline is, Congress close to approving a new space army. That's very exciting. It's on Gizmodo. What do you know? Do you know anything about Gizmodo? Is that a real thing?
Yeah,
they're real, right? So I took that quiz on New York Times about can you spot fake news and real news, and I really did very badly. So somebody read this story and tell me what you think, because it must not. I mean, I can't even imagine. Okay, so if it's real, our political system has completely lost its shit. So. Mainstream pundits bemoan the fragmentation of polarization of society and the role of media in dividing the population, which is a lament that supports the ideological work that appeals to unity do. And I think also another point to make is that the things we think of as fiction can be more true than what counts as fact for the fact checker. So I would argue, for example, that Mad Max Fury Road, Handmaid's Tale, and even Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, where youths mobilize themselves as a militia against the fascist regime of Dolores Umbridge, I think that these things contain truths about our side's experience and struggle better than most articles in the Washington Post. Our side has journalists, yes, but as we have seen this weekend, also poets, artists, critics, and storytellers. and comics. As Edelman points out, effective political persuasion requires not only facts and arguments, but also narrative, image, emotion, and spectacle. And we do have the means at our disposal of interpreting the world on the basis of our experiences and knowledge. So there are their facts and worldviews and ours. And in this sense, it is our job to produce what Kellyanne Conway said were alternative facts. I hate to even say that, but okay. So lessons from our own side that include a critique of capitalism and its ideologies, and therefore the forefronting of knowledge about our experience in it and our fight against it. And so by alternative facts, I certainly don't mean what Kellyanne Conway meant, which is complete obliviousness to the real world. And also, I don't mean satire or falsehoods, but I follow Hungarian Marxist Georg Lukács, who gave us a way to understand how facts are perspectival or have class belonging. So he was the inventor of the idea of standpoint theory, later taken up by feminism, that the working class possesses a distinct standpoint in society with experiences in capitalism that is a source for alternative explanations for suffering and social crisis. One task of revolution is to put forward such alternatives to reach workers with a version of reality that resonates with the experience of exploitation and oppression. In other words, revolutionaries help the class to develop a political analysis and program to confront capitalism itself. In this sense, I would argue that we embrace not necessarily alternative empirical facts, but alternative visions of the world as it is and should be. And so this recognition is not cynical. It just recognizes that we need media of our own to put forward history and struggles from the vantage point of ordinary people. And indeed, our side has a proud history of reporting our history and struggles. Famously, this is historian Howard Zinn, dedicated his life's work to telling the story of the past from the point of view of Native Americans, slaves, women, the working class, and all fighters against oppression and exploitation. And knowledge about history looks very different when you tell it from that perspective. The U.S. radical tradition, of course, features the ruthless journalistic documentation of the experiences of ordinary people. Ida B. Wells began to report on the horrors of lynching in 1889, first in the broader black press and then in her pamphlet, Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases. She edited an anti-segregation newspaper, Free Speech and Light. And raising money from black women's clubs, she undertook a campaign of investigative journalism that showed, among other things, that lynching was not only a product of the vilest racism, but also performed a function of class discipline during economic crisis. She debunked the myth that white women were at risk of rape from all black men. So her journalism presented our truths, right? Likewise, the radical abolitionist Frederick Douglass founded and edited his paper, The North Star, near my home in upstate New York. Based in Syracuse, it became simply Frederick Douglass's paper, but the North Star title was a reference to the directions given to runaway slaves trying to reach the northern states in Canada. Follow the North Star. About this work, Douglass said, "I still see before me a life of toil and trials, but justice must be done. The truth must be told. I will not be silent." More recently, truth tellers for our side have provided the knowledge and the inspiration for our struggles. Naomi Klein's journalism, including the recent No Is Not Enough, published on Haymarket Press, has deeply informed resistance to capitalism. Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Is a long-standing and stalwart bastion against the pro-capitalist distortions of the corporate media, a daily resource for our fight. Among other contributions, Glenn Greenwald has given voice, among other things, to our nation's boldest whistleblowers, Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning. And our own revolutionary tradition, inspired by the revolution 100 years ago in Russia, also looks to the importance of having our own media to tell our truths and organize our struggles. In Russia, Iskra, or Spark, was founded by revolutionaries in 1900, published in exile under Tsarist repression, and smuggled into Russia to inform radicalizing social democrats and workers' organizations. And its motto was, "From a spark, a flame will rise." Until 1905, Lenin believed that the paper should be a central organizing tool of revolutionaries, and of course after that too, I don't know why I put until 1905, used to consolidate experience and knowledge to put forward a clear political line. Iskra fell under the control of reformist Mensheviks, and then the Bolsheviks took the helm of a new paper, Pravda, or Truth. The truth the Bolsheviks wanted to promulgate was not a set of objective, nonpartisan, dry facts, but an account of the experiences, plans, and arguments, all geared to the practical tasks of revolution. And it stopped, of course, again, serving that function when it became a mouthpiece of the Stalinist regime. But it had been an integral part of the revolution. And I know you might have been to other socialist worker-sponsored meetings and have heard Lenin's arguments about the newspaper, but I think it's worth saying that he explained in the pamphlet what is to be done, that workplace experience and struggle over economic issues would never be enough to develop political analysis and train members of a revolutionary organization in our history, politics, theory, and strategy. And so the work of a paper combines the strength of local organization and experience with generalized insights appearing in a form that can unite people across distance. Economic struggle or movement struggle without political clarity cannot do this work alone. And so Lenin wrote, "The masses will never learn to conduct the political struggle until we help to train leaders for this struggle, both from among the workers and from among intellectuals. Such leaders can acquire training training solely by systematically evaluating all the aspects of our political life, all attempts at protest and struggle on the part of the various classes and on various grounds." And he's refuting a counter-argument that sort of knowledge would arise spontaneously in political strategy from people's experience. But Lenin basically said you need the groundwork of people's experience and their deep knowledge of what it's like to live in capitalism, and also media that can provide a framework. And so he was basically saying that we can't contrast the political newspaper as work to the political work in the localities, that these things are dialectically related. And so he goes on to explain that in a country where the working class is spread apart and where hardly anyone has been exposed to revolutionary political ideas, he says it is possible to begin only by inducing people to think about all of these things, to summarize and generalize all of the diverse signs of ferment and active struggle. The only way live political work can be begun is with live political agitation, which is impossible unless we have an all-Russian newspaper frequently issued and regularly distributed. And so, just to say a little bit more about that, Lenin compares the function of the paper to bricklaying, and he says, "A cohesive team of bricklayers, all armed with the knowledge they need, can make quick work of a building." But, he writes, "It is unfortunate that as yet we have no experienced bricklayers trained for teamwork, and that bricks are often laid where they're not needed at all, or that they are not laid according to the general line, but are so scattered that the enemy can shatter the structure as if it were made of sand and not of bricks." And so he says, a newspaper is not only a collective propagandist and an agitator, it is also a collective organizer. And so famously he compared the paper to the scaffolding erected around a building that facilitates the work of the builders. So this idea that we need an outlet for our side, and one that not only reports news, but also trains an organization to work together, has been common sense in social movements and revolutionary struggles around the world. The idea of a revolutionary paper took hold in the United States well before the Russian Revolution. The American Revolution had its own outlets, including newspapers and pamphlets that could distill and generalize the project of a rising bourgeois class. And so we can think about Thomas Paine there, which I don't have time to go into. The Russian Revolution inspired radicals in the 20th century and into the present with regard to publishing media for our side. Along with socialist organizations, radical anti-racist workers recognized the importance of the newspaper at the Dodge plant in Detroit in 1968. The Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, or DRUM, published a newsletter, eventually taking over the student newspaper at Wayne State University to put their platform for black working class organization out front in the struggle. The paper was a site for sharing information and conducting debates central to the movement and its direction. As we know also, the Black Panthers had a paper which included the brilliant artworks of Emery Douglas, who painted black revolutionaries, families, and workers as agents of their own futures. Revolutionary organizations around the world have depended upon making their own media to convey their truths, interpretations of history, theories of oppression, and strategies for resistance. There are hundreds of papers and publications in world history that put forward the experience and analysis of radicals and revolutionaries. And of course, you will find members of the ISO carrying, displaying, and reading the Socialist Worker. And it's not because we make a fetish of the newspaper, like we're hip to modern media and our website, updated daily, is a testament to that. But there is really nothing like a newspaper that condenses the news of our movement to be able to put into the hands of people we meet and use as the basis of conversation. It is a tool and a banner that identifies us as revolutionaries in every setting, and as we keep saying, we should carry it, sell it, and read it. A note about reading. Reading about our traditions, our theory, our history, and our struggles is absolutely crucial to our development as an organization that comes together around shared ideas. Every revolution requires shared knowledge and analysis. And of course, you can find ours in Socialist Worker, but also on our website, in the books from the International Socialist Review, Haymarket Books, all of the talks at this conference, the podcasts at wearemany.org. And it should be noted that our speakers and authors represent some of the most prominent, clear, and exacting left intellectuals and activists on the left, including Howard Zinn, may he rest, Klein, Goodman, Rebecca Solnit, Angela Davis, Ali Abanima, Dave Zirin, Sharon Smith, Deepa Kumar, Andrade Roy, and Kianga Yamada Taylor, among dozens of others. Along with Haymarket, wearemany.org, and so on, so here's my point. The Socialist Worker puts forward not just any radical point of view, it's not a generalist magazine, but the particulars of a working class analysis and history about the working class's importance and power. And that's why when we are told that the title and style won't appeal to the mass of the population, we say that's kind of the point, like to identify and reach working class fighters against oppression who are seeking alternatives to the mainstream news. So it is crucial for us to speak truth to power and to share truths among ourselves. As Ida B. Wells said, the way to right wrongs is to turn the truth upon them. But our truths are not those of the Washington Post or the Democratic Party or the elitist pundits who think working people cannot understand their own experience. The truth is that we don't live in a post-truth era. We are living in an era in which it is becoming clearer and clearer that there are their truths, many of which are outright lies, and ours. We mobilize our analysis and experience to change the world. And to paraphrase Frederick Douglass, we still see before us a life of toil and trials. But justice must be done, the truth must be told, and we will not be silent.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.